You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists warn we are in the sixth great mass extinction event here on Earth, but it doesn't look like it to the average person. What if extinction is not a sudden event like we see in the movies, like an asteroid hit, but it's a long, slow decline? A new theory suggests that was the pattern about 251 million years ago, when up to three-quarters of all land species went extinct. They disappeared. Earth deforested on a global scale, and a depleted ozone layer may have been a surprise driving force. This shatters our assumptions about how extinction works. The new paper was just published February 2018 in Science Advances. The title is UVB-Induced Forest Sterility, Implications of Ozone Shield Failure in Earth's Largest Extinction. The lead author is a rising star in ancient botany, PhD candidate and researcher Jeff P. Benka. He's from the Loy Lab at the University of California in Berkeley. Jeff Benka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
When you came to Berkeley from the University of Washington, what did you bring with you?
So when I came from University of Washington, I gained a background in studying ecosystems from a fisheries ecology perspective and in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. And there I met a few people who actually were working with ultraviolet B radiation associated with ozone weakening. And I also then worked with a number of folks in paleobotany in the lab of Dr. Caroline Stromberg and the lab of mass extinction paleobiologist Dr. Peter Ward. And during those years, I really started getting an idea of, oh, well, there's a lot of interesting sorts of connections between what modern ecologists are looking at in biology today and maybe what we could learn about the distant past.
We've had Dr. Peter Ward on the show, I think it's three times. I love his work. In this new paper, you say an unanticipated result tipped you into a new adventure in science. What happened?
When we went into this research, we were interested in figuring out how pollen grains in the fossil record, why they might look malformed. And one of the ideas is that maybe there was ozone weakening going on in the past. And so we decided to design an experiment to test this idea or this hypothesis on modern lineages of plants that were produced very similar pollen to the lineages affected 250 million years ago during the end Permian extinction. And while we went into the study expecting to possibly see these malformed pollen grains as sort of a fingerprint of environmental stress, we were really taken aback and surprised by the observation that the trees in our chamber experiment actually had all of their seed cones die prematurely. So their seed cones died before fertilization. And that really got us thinking about a different way in which this extinction may have played out for ecosystems.
So the trees didn't die, but their reproductive cones did.
Exactly. So in pine trees, there are two different types of cones that are produced. You may all be familiar with seeing the products of one of these cones, pollen cones. Each year, you might get a dusting of yellow pollen at certain times, and that's oftentimes from very large pollen grains of pines and their relatives. The second type of cone is a seed cone, and that's often what we term these big woody pine cones. And it was those seed cones, the pine cones, that we were seeing that were dying before they were able to receive sperm from pollen grains during fertilization.
We know that ultraviolet rays coming from the sun can be really harmful to human eyes and skin, and scientists break down those rays into three basic types that I'm aware of, A, B, and C. Why do you focus on UVB?
We were focusing on UVB because this is one of the most biologically relevant wavelengths. It's a short wavelength that often causes mutations in DNA. So we here on Earth get exposed to both ultraviolet A or UVA and UVB radiation. But a lot of times the UVB is what biologists are most concerned with in terms of mutation.
So we need to enter this time machine. Your paper looks at the worst mass extinction event on the planet. How do we even know the Permian-Triassic extinction happened?
The Permian-Triassic extinction was a major event in geological history, and it really came together as an observation of the disappearance of very large percentages of fossilized life forms. So predominantly we're talking about marine ecosystems. So a lot of times marine or oceanic sediments are where much of the fossil preservation takes place in the world. I mean, that's where we get at least some of the most complete records of what's going on over time. And in marine sediments, we see these just massive disappearances of animals, say, with hard shells that readily fossilize. It's almost sort of a sudden event. They're there, and then they're gone when you're looking up basically a rock section. And for a long time, paleontologists have been puzzled about why this difference in animal diversity between the end of the Permian period and the early Triassic period. And there have been many, many different sorts of ideas for how these oceanic extinctions happened. And actually, your former guest, Peter Ward, does a lot of research on this and has found some very interesting things. And in our case, we actually are trying to figure out what's going on land. It's a very different system than the ocean. There's different forces probably at play. And in land, we see as these marine species disappear, we actually see a very interesting change in land plants. My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, here at UC Berkeley, during her dissertation years ago, working with her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, they found that in marine sediments of Greenland, that pollen assemblages that were deposited right in the same sediments that we see this change in shelly faunas or animal assemblages, there is this sort of pulsed change in the vegetation going on. And they published this noting that there seemed to be this disappearance of woody seed plants. So there were these diverse conifer and what we call gymnosperm-dominated plant groups that really started to dwindle during several points. But the really weird thing is that they didn't just go extinct like the animals did. The plants actually persisted, and they actually lived long enough to basically recover and then get hit again by something. So there was this repeated deforestation sort of pulsed change in the forest community that was going on, and we see the same sorts of plant lineages moving out of the system over and over again until eventually, much further down the line, some of these lineages, for instance, many of the conifer lineages, didn't make it, and only a few were able to survive the actual full crisis.
Now, what are the Siberian traps, and how do they fit into the accepted story of this mass extinction?
So the Siberian traps are what we call a large igneous province. It's a very massive area that was formed by volcanic activity that spans much of northern Russia today. And the Siberian traps were really pertinent for the end Permian extinction because they basically formed at the same time as this extinction happened. And there's been a number of recent studies that have been looking to date the lava flows and the lava deposits of this volcanic province to figure out just how that timing lines up with the extinction. And recent years, it's been found that some of these eruptive sort of intervals probably lined up very closely, more or less, give a few, you know, tens of thousands of years, which is very short, geologically speaking. And the eruption ceased about, we think, maybe about 500,000 years into the early Triassic period. So it's somewhere from tens of thousands to a million years of volcanic activity that was going on across a very large area of what is now Russia. And this sort of volcanic province has been tied to, or at least has been proposed to be tied to, many of the phenomena we see in the animal records. Scientists propose that many, many different sort of environmental impacts that volcanoes can have on the environment may have really pushed life past its tipping point. For instance, these volcanoes likely produced loads of methane and carbon dioxide, well-known greenhouse gases today, that would have probably accelerated and pushed Earth into these sort of hothouse worlds, basically like these extreme global warming episodes that are sort of our doomsday calculations for the future. And that's one thing on the one hand that has really been proposed as driving a lot of these environmental changes, among many others. There's also heavy metals, acid rain that have been proposed to have wreaked havoc on land. One of the problems, though, with some of these hypotheses is that we don't really know how we can explain the plant dynamics using them. So in many cases, the acid rain sort of idea is quite interesting and quite pertinent to what we've seen in recent years with industrial pollution. But the problem with that idea is that acid rain is a localized phenomenon, roughly speaking. So the Siberian traps were actually erupting up in what is now or what would have been the Arctic at that time. And so a lot of these sorts of extremely stressful conditions would have been going on in the northern hemisphere. They wouldn't have reached down to the southern hemisphere to the same extent. And that's where we also see forest collapses.
With the volcanic activity, a lot of it over thousands of years, how does that impact the ozone and therefore the UVB rays that you were studying?
My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, and her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, discovered that across the world during this mass extinction, there is this proliferation of what look like abnormal spores. Particularly, they're spores that are clustered in groups of fours called tetrads, and they were produced by a lineage of plants called lycophytes today. They're represented today by modern club mosses, quillworts, and spike mosses that you can find, say, if you go hiking in the mountains in North America or elsewhere. Now, the thing that was interesting about these spores and that really tipped them off that something might be going on is that it seems that these spores were unseparated during the process of meiosis, the process of basically spore production. And this would suggest that something was disrupting the reproductive process of plants worldwide. These spores were all over the world where you looked, and there were many of them. So they proposed an idea that Siberian traps might have been causing massive destruction to the ozone layer. And this idea came out of similar ideas with the Siberian trap generating gases that could cause atmospheric degradation or pollution, similar to industrial pollution today. That study was published in 2004. And about 5 years later, in 2009, a team of scientists led by Dr. Henrik Svensson found that volcanic sediments that formed around basically eruptive pipes of the Siberian traps, when you take these rock sediments and you stick them in chambers and heat them, they release massive amounts of methyl chloride, an ozone-depleting compound. These volcanoes actually were erupting possibly in the absolute wrong place at the wrong time. Across Siberia, there were these massive evaporated seaways. We call them halite deposits or salt deposits today. And these salt deposits basically were getting either punctured or heated by these magma conduits. And as the Siberian traps was forming, this whole gigantic region was having a lot of heating of these salts. And heating of those salts, even passively, can release and unlock methyl chloride and methyl bromide, ozone-depleting compounds that can reach the stratosphere and rip holes in the ozone layer in the Arctic.
Now, just to be clear, when we are looking at CO2 in the past, we can go through, for example, ice cores from Greenland or Antarctica and go back at least 100,000 years, and measure little bubbles and find out what the carbon dioxide was. But we don't have any mechanism to directly measure the ozone levels 250 million years ago, do we? Or do we just depend on the way that the impacts are seen?
At the moment, we don't have a direct way of measuring UV radiation in the past. However, there's exciting new research coming out of a team, I believe, that's in England right now, that's led by a researcher by the name of Wesley Fraser. And he and I believe Barry Lomax and a number of other colleagues there have developed a way to look at the chemistry of fossilized pollen and spore walls that actually can be used potentially to figure out the levels of UV radiation that these plants may have been experiencing. So the thought is that plants oftentimes invest sunscreen-like pigments, We call, for instance, one of them is called flavonoids, that they basically put into their spore or pollen walls. It probably helps give a lot of pollen its yellow color if you do see it in conifers. But the amount of that sunscreen that is basically produced by the plant oftentimes has a direct relationship to the amount of radiation the plant receives. So in the coming years, you may well be able to be seeing some studies coming out on the N-permian from that group. I know they've been really working hard testing this with other systems and more recent sediments, and they've found their results so far are very promising, that this, what we call a proxy or an indicator, might actually have some application to the N-permian.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with my guest Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. We're talking about damaged ozone and mass extinction. Do we know, Jeff, what the level of ozone is when tree cones begin to become damaged, begin to become less fertile?
So we don't know exactly what the level, the threshold of ultraviolet radiation exposure actually will induce infertility in trees or start seeing a noticeable impact on their inability to produce seeds. More work definitely needs to be done looking at lower UVB levels than what we looked at in our experiment. But what we found in our study was that the lowest UV treatment that we used that was simulating what was modeled through paleoatmospheric and geochemical models was 7.2 times the modern amount of UV radiation that, say, you would get on a really sunny day here in California, which is enough. You should be putting on sunscreen if you're hanging out outside in the middle of the day in California. These were extremely high radiation levels we were testing for these trees, otherworldly, you would say. But we really don't know, because this actually is the first study where anyone has actually looked at the reproductive biology of a non-flowering plant under high UV radiation and whether it impacts that. So we're really just at the tip of the iceberg here. I think that, you know, a number of research studies could be done that could really explore how low the increase of UV could be to actually impact our forest health in the world today.
You also talk in the paper, and this goes to your previous discussion about pulses, but you talk about a forest recession episode. Are they prevalent in Earth's past, and why do those happen that way?
So the forest recessions that happen at the N-Permian are pretty unique to that event in the pattern that they happen. There definitely are areas where we see an instance of deforestation after the asteroid impact when the dinosaurs went extinct at the Cretaceous Paleogene. And that's sort of a widely cited and mentioned effect of that extinction, is that we see a decline in the forest vegetation in our fossil pollen spore and what we call macrofossil assemblages, so large actual fossils of plants. The really unique thing about the N-Permian is that we get this really unique turnover in the vegetation, and it happens over and over and over again. It's strange. And eventually, at the very end of these forest recessions and recovery intervals, we see the disappearance of a number of these lineages, and it almost seems like there just was something that was stressing these communities out, you know, over thousands and thousands of years, that the trees and the plants were resilient, they were survivors, but eventually some of them weren't able to take it after a while. So it really is a testament that something was going on that snuffed out a lot of the animals that the plants were able to tolerate for a very long time.
Do you think some ancient plants had better ways to cope with UVB light, and so maybe they survived with a better competitive advantage?
Yes, we do think that's quite plausible. I mean, these plants are being subjected potentially for tens to hundreds to thousands of years of whatever conditions were present in the Permian world, and with that, there was probably very intense selectivity going on in the ecosystem. So some lineages, some strains, some genetically, there might have been some populations that were more resilient and possibly selected for over time. I mean, when I say selected for, that sounds very deterministic, but they probably had traits that were advantageous for coping with ultraviolet. And one of the lineages of plants that was out there that really was a champion of this extinction is one that my advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, spent some time studying. And they were these lycophytes, the ones that were forming these weird spore tetrads. We really have no idea what they were doing exactly at this time, but they took over the world. In each one of these deforestation episodes, we see possibly just a handful of genera of these lycophytes just pop up, and they're there. And there's sort of these low-diversity ecosystems dominated by these spore-bearing fern-like plants that really aren't related closely to ferns at all, but do very different things.
If the forests began to die due to infertility from UVB, due to ozone depletion, how do you connect that to the much larger extinction of plants and animals of all kinds that happened around 250 million years ago?
One of the ideas we're having with this extinction is that by disrupting the reproductive capacity of dominant plant lineages around the world, and dominant is really kind of an anthropomorphic term. I mean, these are lineages of plants that seem to be very common and very prevalent in many assemblages we see in the fossil pollen and spore records. But the idea that we have here is that as these forests were unable to replace themselves over time, if you had, say, pulsed ozone weakening from these volcanic outbursts over and over again over thousands of years, we may have seen recession of the forests over generations, and with that, the disappearance of fundamental niches of animals around the world. In a way, we're proposing a different way of looking at extinction and the end Permian in general, in that it is a very dramatic event, and we don't want to downplay that by any means. But the mechanism by which this extinction and possibly other mass extinctions have happened may really have more to do with the role of natural selection over long periods of time under environmental stresses. And it doesn't necessarily require that anything really is starving to death or dying, but that the ecological space and the niche of organisms is changing over thousands of years, and it's changing the number of possibilities that animals, of where an animal can live and how it can function, and we're seeing the disappearance of ecosystems over time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. This is Radio EcoShock. Now, Jeff, we get to a much stronger warning in your paper that we could be underestimating the threat of thinning ozone. Let's start with the picture you give of what would have happened if the Montreal Protocol banning some of these ozone-killing chemicals wasn't in place.
Yes. If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we could have really been in deep trouble, not only for our own skin cancer, say, for our species, but also for ecosystems in general based on this study. If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we actually, by 2050, might have seen the complete disappearance of the ozone layer in the tropics, which is really alarming and scary. And actually, within the past few days, there's been a new study suggesting that ozone weakening is continuing over at least the tropics, or at least it hasn't really fully healed itself in the way that it has over the Arctic. And we really should still be a little concerned about this and figure out what's causing it. But the other thing that's really alarming about this world-avoided scenario, a previous study done by Newman et al. In 2009 did atmospheric modeling of what the world would look like and its atmosphere would look like by the year, say, 2065. And by that time, we would probably see a 550% increase in DNA-damaging UV radiation in the mid-latitudes, so where a lot of people live here in North America and also in the Southern Hemisphere, too. And with that, we may have seen, I mean, much of the world's land surface is covered by coniferous forests. So the coniferous taiga is one of the largest biomes on land today. And what's particularly concerning about this experiment is that though it was done on only a single species of cultivated conifer, it really was a dramatic result that we got. Every single one of these trees was sterilized under all of our increased UV scenarios. And they used the exact same mode of reproduction that a wide range of the conifers dominating the taiga today do. So if we didn't curb these CFCs and ozone depletant pollutants, we might have seen recession over time and possibly disappearance of forests that we rely upon for shelter, timber, but also for our ecosystems in general. And that's a really scary thought.
And you warn we must not slack off on restrictions on chemicals that can damage the ozone layer. Is anybody suggesting that?
We do suggest that. And as far as I know, I haven't necessarily seen direct proposals to curtail ozone or basically the CFCs or any ozone depleting pollutants. But I think that one of the big issues now is that politically we're in a time where there are economic incentives sometimes that are short-term to lessen or curtail restrictions on environmental pollutants. And we're seeing that here in the United States at the moment, which is a concern to a lot of researchers. But the ozone problem is really a long-term issue, too. It's got some parallels to climate change and CO2 and methane emissions. But one of the things that's still really of concern for this is that there are newer chemicals that we are producing that we don't always know all of the environmental effects down the road of when they get in the atmosphere. So some environmental pollutants that are still out there still are able to damage ozone, stratospheric ozone, to some extent. So we need to just make sure that we are really doing rigorous study on these environmental pollutants and continuing to do so, so that we avoid possibly reintroducing a new problem inadvertently.
Jeff, your new paper suggests a new way of looking at mass extinction and the risk of ozone depletion. It is new science. Would you call this a theory, a postulate, or what?
Well, it's funny. My co-author, Dr. Ivo Downstay, on this paper has really been very heavily influential in this new, what we call this new view of extinction. And he often says that it's not really new. It's not necessarily new. It's also should be an old view of how extinctions are. Really, what we're proposing is, I mean, we're a team in a biology department, and it's interesting because being amongst biologists day in and day out, we think about these events possibly a little differently than we would if we were mostly thinking about the geology of the situation. And to modern biologists who study modern ecosystems, I mean, it's incredibly hard to figure out what drivers of ecological change are in the modern world, even if you have all the advanced tools and technologies at your fingertips. So trying to look back 250 million years is really, it's almost unfathomable. But one of the things that we got out of sort of talking to modern biologists and thinking about this is that there are modern systems today that give us an idea of what maybe an extinction world would have looked like. And one of the really, really compelling examples of this is the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And you see all these very gripping film footage, photography that is done in this area where a number of biologists are working. Some of them, I think you've actually even interviewed in the past. But you see that Chernobyl looks like a beautiful, idyllic landscape right now. If you didn't know what had happened there, and you were ignoring, say, the ruins of what was going on there, you'd probably put up a tent and go camping or backpacking there. And you'd see all sorts of wildlife and all sorts of trees, parklands. But there's really more insidious things going on that are unseen. And to a biologist or someone who studies ecosystems, you really have to put together a lot of pieces of information before you see a dramatic sort of impact going on in the ecosystem. And that may play out over tens to thousands of years, and we may not know it. So the view that we see with extinctions in the past is that maybe they weren't these massive die-offs. Maybe it was more insidious, smaller changes that affected the selectivity of certain lineages over time. And over time, you have the disappearance of lineages. Dr. Downstay really argues in many cases that we really should think of mass extinctions as the termination of lineages on the tree of life. It's not necessarily that everything drops dead. It's that evolutionary lineages disappear over geologic time at a faster rate than newer lineages or newer branches to the tree of life can sprout.
Yes, you conclude in the discussion part of your paper, environmental disasters in the past and present, for example, current anthropogenic climate change, are therefore not always easily perceived as they unfold. That's kind of a scary thought, that we could be blindly walking into a slow-moving environmental disaster right now and not know it.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about paradigm-busting new science. In my opinion, the paper is UVB-induced forced sterility, implications of ozone shield failure in Earth's largest extinction. Our guest is Jeff Benka from the UC Museum of Paleontology and the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of California in Berkeley. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all the time we have, at least for this week. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.